The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
One of the things I saw in the municipality where I was staying, and this is why it's often so hard to tease out one factor from the other, is that the lack of jobs in the coffee industry were pushing young men from this municipality to go to Guatemala City. And then 2 years ago, two of the men who were working as bus drivers were murdered. And so at that point, a lot of the other young men from the city decided, well, maybe I'm actually safer off trying to go to the U.S. and stay with my cousin. And so that's where it starts to get complicated. You have all these factors coming together, where the economic options are disappearing. And then at the same time, the cities where you might be going to are so dangerous. And so it starts to feel like there's no place for you in your country anymore.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 27th, 2018. There is a caravan. You've probably heard something about it. Stephanie Loiter has heard something about it. She is the director of the Mexico Security Initiative at the Robert S. Strauss Center for International Security and Law and a frequent Lawfare contributor, and she was down on the Mexico-Guatemala border, a different part of the Mexico-Guatemala border, this past week, traveling with migrants who are following a trail not unlike that of the caravan. She and I caught up Friday afternoon following her return to the United States, and we talked about why people are joining this caravan, what the alternatives to it are, and why certain migrants are shunning it. We talked about the pushes out of countries like Honduras and Guatemala, and we talked about what it's like to be a child on the long trek to the United States. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 359, The Migrant Caravan and Its Dissenters. All right, let's start with the caravan. You were not with the caravan in southern Mexico, but you were doing long walks with migrants who were engaged in somewhat the same activity that the caravan was is about. So start by telling us where you were in relation to the caravan and what are the sort of things about the caravan that people should understand but don't.
Sure. So I was on the other side or the other end of the border from where the caravan entered into Mexico. So the caravan entered into Mexico in a city called Ciudad Hidalgo, which is about under an hour drive from the bigger city, which more people have heard of in Mexico, which is Tapachula, which is a southern city in the state of Chiapas. Now, that's along the Pacific coast of Mexico, right on the border with Guatemala. And if you kind of go due north, you go straight north, and you're going towards the Gulf of Mexico, you pass through an area of the border that is the jungle. Really, it's the Lacandon jungle. And there, right in the jungle, there's a small port of entry. I really actually shouldn't call it a port of entry because it's really just two small towns, one on each side of the dividing river. Then the river is the international line. And on the Guatemala side, it's the small little town is called La Tecnica. And on the Mexico side, the town is called Frontera Corozal. And that's where primarily Honduran migrants arrive. And they take buses or they hitchhike or they walk through Guatemala. And then once they get to La Tecnica, they disembark, they walk down to the river, they get on a boat, They take the boat across to Frontera Corozal, and from there they either hop into taxis that are going to take them to the next big city, roughly about 3 hours away by driving, maybe a little more, which is Palenque, which is also famous for having beautiful Mayan ruins. Or if they don't have any money, if they decide that they don't want to take a taxi, usually only because they A, don't have money, or B, they really don't trust the taxi drivers, then they set out walking, and they walk for between 5 and 7 days to reach, again, this first city. Now, in essence, the people who are making this trek, I almost see them as leaving in mini caravans. I mean, really mini caravans. They're leaving in groups of 5, 6, 10 people, up to maybe 15 or 20 at the most, because they don't want to be too big. So they don't want to attract too much attention, which is in essence the opposite of the caravan happening at the other end of the border, where the goal really is to attract attention, and it's to be as big as possible, because through those numbers of people, that's how you get protection. That's how you make a political point. And that's how you're able to walk right through borders and checkpoints without documents. You can't do that if you're a group of 5 people who are crossing in La Técnica, but you can do that if you're a group of 5,000 people just walking right across the bridge out of Guatemala into Mexico. So there's a power in numbers.
So you mention a few distinct points associated with that power in numbers. One is protection, safety, and one is political statement. And one is, I suppose, kind of force of numbers being able to do things like walk across borders that individuals or small groups of people can't do. And I'm interested in which of those or in what combination those things are driving the caravan. Is this fundamentally about, safety and just size being safer, or is it fundamentally a political statement?
I think it's fundamentally a running away from very negative conditions in Honduras. That has to be where you begin, because you can't get this many people to abandon their homes, their communities, their schools, their families, their jobs. You cannot do that unless the situation feels to many people unbearable. That has to be the starting point. But now the question there is, why have 7,000 people again decided to go together? And why aren't they spreading out into the smaller groups the way that they're continuing to do across the other side of the border? And that's where the factors that you're mentioning come in. So the way I see it, there's really thinking about it from someone from a Honduran's perspective, say, who wants to join a caravan. Why would you join? There are a couple reasons. First, you would join because of the safety in numbers, which is protection, but also means you can do many more things. You can enter into Mexico. You can walk right by the INM checkpoints. You're not worried about deportation. These are all positives. And number two, you're not worried about being preyed upon by criminal groups, by local actors, corrupt police asking for a bribe. You can move pretty far into Mexico. If you're thinking about it from a Honduran's perspective, you'd look at past caravans and you'd say, hey, they got at least to Mexico City. So you could get, or they got all the way to the border. So you can imagine being, interested in joining this group to get pretty far without having to show papers or worry about deportation. Number two, I kind of view this in essence as also a protest against the smugglers, because their rates are so high right now because of the risk.
What do the smugglers charge?
It costs between $7,000 and $10,000 right now to go from anywhere in Central America to the U.S.-Mexico border, or actually a little further into the United States. So up to Houston or San Antonio. And so that's an enormous amount of money for a lot of these people. They'll have to take out loans. They'll have to sell property. They'll have to, again, perhaps take out have a gift from someone in the U.S. or a loan that they have to pay back, maybe a family member who migrated previously. And so to avoid having to take out that amount of money, or even if they only had to take out half that amount of money, that's, that's another one of the reasons you would join, or that you would join a caravan, to get pretty far into the country before having to contract a smuggler. So some of it is protection. Some of it is the power of moving in a group and what that means. And some of it is just you're saving money. You're going to get, even if you separated from the caravan in Mexico City or in Monterrey, and you only had to pay the smuggler who brought you from Monterrey to Houston, that's about $3,500. You're cutting your costs in half. So there's a lot of reasons why it might be attractive to someone. On the flip side, it's not attractive to everyone. So the migrants that, about half of the migrants that I met in La Técnica were saying, no way, we do not want to go with the caravan, because you also get all the attention that comes with being a group of that size. So while some people in the caravan might see it as a good thing because civil society groups might be now offering you food and other people might offer you rides, migrants on the other side said, no way, that's going to ruffle feathers too much. I'd rather stay over here in my group of four, quiet, migrating just like hundreds of thousands of people have migrated before, invisible through the country. That's my best chance at getting to the United States, not in a group of 7,000.
And so in the group of seven or five or, half a dozen that you were working with, were any of them interested in joining the caravan? Or is this a sort of self-selected group of people who are in the no way, no how, while they're making a whole lot of noise up on the Pacific coast, I'm going to quietly slip through department?
About half and half, I'd say, it would be how I'd break it down. There were some who were saying, oh, maybe I can meet up with the caravan when it gets a little further north. And so I'll head up this way and it should loop back towards Veracruz. And so I can meet up with it then and join it for the last leg and save that money. And then there was kind of the flip side of exactly what you're saying of, while they attract all the attention down there, I'm at the other end of the border and I'm just going to quietly cross and go all the way from the southern border up to the northern border. So we'll focus migration's attention on stopping them, and hopefully there'll be fewer people in my path as I go north.
So if I were in that group, one advantage that I would expect is speed. It's hard to move 7,000 people 1,000 miles, right? Whereas yes. Seven people, you can hitch rides, you can probably walk faster than a large crowd can walk, you can jump on trains. I mean, there's a lot of ways to move seven people that don't work for 7,000 people. Are they in fact moving faster than the caravan?
Absolutely. And I think you hit on one of the key points, which is the downside of taking the caravan is the speed. You're just going to move at a much slower pace. And this is the downside of not taking a smuggler as well. So when you were talking about the seven people who jump on the train and who are walking as fast as they can, those are also the people who are crossing Mexico without guides, without smugglers, someone taking them and guiding them north. Now, I think the surveys suggest that about 60% of people do take these expensive guides through Mexico. And the benefit of that you don't see in the caravan is that people who have smugglers are boarding taxis, they're boarding buses. In really VIP cases, they're boarding planes on fake documents to go to the border. And so they're making this journey. If you're in the caravan, you're looking at a month, 2 months before you make it to the U.S.-Mexico border. And if you are on a bus that's going direct from one of the major cities in southern Mexico to the border, you're looking at 3 to 5 days once you get started. So it's more expensive, but you get the speed of arriving within a week, within 2 weeks, versus if you're trying to go on your own, number one, it's already going to take you longer. But if you're going on your own in a group of 7,000, it's going to take you even longer. So it's absolutely, that's a downside for migrants. So I think what we'll start seeing is that as that big group keeps going further into Mexico, we'll start to see groups splintering off. People who think, it was great this group got me this far. I didn't have to pay any bribes. I got to go past all those checkpoints and I got some hot meals. And I'm glad that I was part of this moment when migrants came together and this was great, but you know what? Now it's time for me to break off and to hop aboard that train or, take a bus or do something else to try to get north, perhaps before the majority of people get there and the U.S. government really responds with force.
So tell us about the group of people that you were with and how long you were with them for and who they are.
Sure. At La Tecnica, where all the migrants are coming over, there are roughly 300 people were crossing every day while I was there. About 50% of those people had a guide. And so they were crossing in a group with their guide who was paying for everything. And then they hopped in taxis and they left. The other 50%, so it's about between 100 and 150 people a day, were taking off walking. Now, as you're driving along the highway, you pass all these groups. And at some point, I decided that, you know, it's striking how much it looks like a humanitarian crisis. You know, as you're driving along these jungle roads and there are people, you know, 10 people here, 15 people here, carrying all their stuff on their backs. A lot of them have little kids, so they'll have the kids on their shoulders. They'll be carrying the kids. And you really feel like there is a humanitarian crisis happening in this part of Mexico. And so at some point I thought, I really want to get a chance to talk to these people, to understand it's an incredibly long 100-mile journey, what it's like to walk, especially with small children. So on my last day that I was down there, I took off with a group of, it ended up being six adult men, one woman, and her six-year-old child. And so we took off, all of us, and began walking. And I thought, I'll walk with them for a few hours and kind of get a sense. And during that time, we talked, you know, kind of about who they were. They were all from Honduras. A lot of them were from different cities across Honduras, some of the smaller cities, not the big cities of San Pedro Sula or Tegucigalpa. A lot of them had been working in construction, the men, some in agriculture, in small farms outside the cities. And they were telling me that this group in particular, all of them were leaving because of economic reasons, because they just couldn't, even if they were working full time, they couldn't even afford kind of the basic food staples, which meant that when I asked all of this group, well, when's the last time that you had three solid meals a day? And they all just laughed because they were, you know, maybe we had three meals last week, but every day since then we've had two or one meal. And they kind of all listed their salaries and compared it to how much everything cost. And just how it was impossible you could work 24 hours a day and you still wouldn't be able to move ahead and let alone buy the necessary food to feed yourself and your family. And so that's why this particular group was leaving. Now, the thing is, how long was I with them? Well, I thought that I would, you know, walk with them for a few hours and jump on a taxi or a bus, you know, one of the many means of transportation that go by. But I hadn't really thought it through that. Well, I'm walking with them also with a backpack because I had all my things in a backpack, that people would think that I was also Honduran and also moving through the paper through the country without papers. And so I ended up walking with them for a lot longer than I expected because I couldn't get a taxi or a bus to stop to pick me up. So I ended up having a whole afternoon from the middle of the day all the way till past the sunset before I was actually able to flag down a taxi to take me. So it was an interesting experience, but really made me understand a lot better just how hard it is to walk those types of distances every day, especially in that weather.
All right. So just to situate people geographically, it is, I suppose, the beginning of the journey for people who are going to make it all the way to the United States, but they have already traversed the entire country of Guatemala, right? These are people who have started in Honduras, walked across Guatemala, have managed to get to southern Mexico. So you're already talking about a lot of days. Of how many days does it take to walk across Guatemala?
Well, a lot of these people took buses across Guatemala, or they hitchhiked. Most of them took buses, though. And why? Because Hondurans can legally enter into Guatemala and cross Guatemala. There's no migratory enforcement that could pick them up and deport them back to Honduras because there's free movement of people. So they can ride buses in Guatemala. It's right to the Guatemala border, which is what they do. And that takes a couple of days. There are some people who really have no money at all, and then they hitchhike and they walk some. And for them, it might take them about a week. That was about what people were telling me. Or a couple of days. It's depending. The times vary by if you're a young man in your 20s and you're moving pretty quick, or if you're a pregnant woman, an elderly person, if you're a parent with a small child, because then you really can't traverse the same distances as someone else who might be, you know, say, a 25-year-old male. And you really see a lot of those individuals who are older, a lot of families, and their time of transiting from one point to the other is dramatically longer than kind of the groups of young people who are moving through at a really quick pace.
This group of people, large numbers of them presumably do not make it as far north as the U.S. border. And when they get to the U.S. border, large numbers of them don't get through. So what is the, you know, if we assume that of a group of seven who's kind of walking north at the Mexico-Guatemala border, what are the drop-off points? There must be sort of Honduran communities across Mexico of people who kind of stopped walking at some point, right?
Well, I think I would break down the number of people who get across primarily along the lines of, did you pay a smuggler or did you not pay a smuggler? Because for those people who paid a smuggler, you have a much better chance of reaching the U.S.-Mexico border. It is going to be probably exponentially higher than if you don't have a smuggler. Those with a guide, so say that 60% of people who cross, their guides, if their guides have done their job properly, will have all the transportation lined up, will have people across the different migration checkpoints who they've already paid a bribe to, kind of in advance. They've worked out these arrangements, and they'll have their connection in the criminal group that organizes that chunk of the border, and they'll have paid them as well. And so everything should be taken care of or is kind of already laid out in front of them as they go forward. And so all of those regular barriers you might think would be in place, like a checkpoint, is no longer a barrier because the guide has already kind of smoothed the way through. That's not the case if you don't have a guide. If you don't have a smuggler, you are on your own. You have to hike around the checkpoints. There's a lot more walking. If you don't have any money, you're going to walk a lot. You're going to be on the train a lot. And if you have a little more money, you're going to be going on and off the colectivos, the small local buses, maybe buying tickets on larger buses. But you're risking it a lot more. And those are the people who are really that are being picked up by migration and sent back.
Honduras, you know, there's been a fair bit of discussion about conditions in Honduras and El Salvador that lead large numbers of people to walk or pay money that they don't have to get out of those countries and to the United States. And you've written a fair bit about it, and you and I have talked about it on the podcast in the past. But for those listeners who have not listened to that or read about it, give us a little refresher. Why are, you know, 7,000 people on the Pacific coast walking away from Honduras, and in the group that you were walking with, seven people walking north away from Honduras? Like, what's there's got to be a heck of a push for people to take that kind of risk.
There are many of those pushes, and all of them are pretty strong. So we'll start with the one that's talked about a lot, and we'll focus on Honduras. You know, one of the first big push factors is the security threats. And when you look at past CBP apprehension data and where people are coming from in Honduras, it's traditionally been the big cities, San Pedro Sula and Tegucigalpa. Now, in these big cities, there are groups, MS-13, Barrio 18, these gangs that control territory and extort people who are living in the territory that they control. Now, for a Honduran, I'll use an example of someone who I met in La Tecnica who was fleeing from violence. He was a taxi driver who operated his taxis in a zone that was controlled by a criminal group. Now, MS-13 was the group who came and asked him for money every week, the quota, and he said that he had to pay just over half the amount of money he made every week to the gangs.
So just to pause on that for a second, you know, the president talks about MS-13 all the time, and he talks about, you know, maybe Nancy Pelosi is a member, right, and Chuck Schumer kind of like a joined up with MS-13. And the result of the way the president talks about MS-13 is that some people really tune out, right, whenever it's mentioned, and it's almost like it's demagoguery and nothing else. This is a serious security problem, and, you know, it's kind of a no-joke organization, even if President Trump is trying to sort of turn it into a political talking point. You're describing a situation in which somebody's walking 1,000 miles to get away from MS-13.
Yes. The number one victims for MS-13 and for its rival group, Buddy Alicio, are Central Americans. This is where the groups have their strongest presence. And the real victims are the people that live in the neighborhoods in Central American cities where they control territory. So for this particular taxi driver, he left. The push factor for him was not paying the quota. The push factor for him was that the gang became angry at the taxi drivers in general. And the weekend before he left, they came up to a meeting. I think it was a meeting of taxi drivers, or they found the taxi drivers across the city. And they killed, he told me, 16 of them in one weekend. And so when you have 16 of your colleagues who are murdered in one weekend, that's when he said, I'm out, I'm done. And that was the push factor that drove him out of Honduras. And there are other cases. I actually met bus drivers who had similar stories. I met two people who had left because incited particularly that really violent weekend as being the moment when they decided. Some of them still had they'd taken their credentials that labeled them as a taxi driver or as a bus driver to be able to use in their asylum cases in the United States to say, this gang was coming after me, this gang was extorting me, and then this gang killed, you know, over 10 of my colleagues in one weekend, and I thought I knew I was next, so I just left as soon as I could, and I took this with me as proof. So you do get those stories. Security, especially in the big cities of Honduras, is a perennial and very serious push factor.
And is Honduras worse than El Salvador or the other countries in the region? I mean, we hear about it a lot right now, but is that just because the caravan is a sort of Honduras in origin thing, or is it because Honduras is actually a unique problem right now?
It's not a unique challenge to Honduras. These gangs have territorial control, not just in the big cities of Honduras, but also in Guatemala City and in the big cities and across a lot of El Salvador. Now, for a reason that's not 100% clear at the moment, after Trump's election, the numbers of migrants from all three Central American countries decreased. Well, over the past months, the past kind of year, the number of migrants coming from Guatemala and Honduras has rebounded to levels that we saw in 2016. Now, El Salvador has never rebounded. They just stayed flat. And it's kind of confusing because it's not that the violence numbers are down, but it's really hard to understand why exactly those numbers from El Salvador have stayed really low. But to get back to your question of, is this a Honduras phenomenon? Absolutely not. It's across the whole region. It's prevalent. You see a lot of people migrating out of every big city for gang violence, for gang extortion, and from the threats that they receive by either not paying the extortion or by perhaps having a son or a daughter that the gang wants to recruit into as a member. And so there's a lot of those factors that go on that push people to decide, I can't stay here anymore. I have to go.
So you describe a lot of push factors. That's one, or maybe two, the recruitment element. What are some of the others?
So the second one that I would point to is the other big kind of bucket of poverty. And that one gets thrown around a lot. There's low employment, there's bad economic conditions. And I spent the past summer, I spent a month out of the past summer in the highlands of Guatemala. And it was really to look at this question of, when we say poverty. When we say low economic opportunity, what do we actually mean? And how does that, you know, it's not that a lot of these places, I didn't feel like looking at the statistics, so these places were really going through economic crises. It wasn't apparent from the general statistics I was looking at. So I wanted to go to these cities and really understand what was happening. And what I found is that there is actually, in many of these small communities right now, there is a sort of collapse happening, a slow motion collapse. And where I saw this most clearly was in the coffee industry.
So when you say a collapse, you mean an economic collapse?
Exactly. So in the coffee industry, what you're seeing right now are low global coffee prices. Now, why does that matter? Because Guatemala's largest rural employer, employing 500,000 people directly, is coffee. And in Honduras, especially in Western Honduras, coffee is also a large rural employer. And so as the global price of coffee is very low, that means that you can be running your coffee farm for 50 years, and you can be producing the same amount of coffee every year, but that amount of coffee that you are able to sell, or the price you're able to sell it at, is dictated by the global price. Now, especially in Guatemala and Honduras, they've been suffering from coffee rust. So these plagues that attack the coffee and ruin their yields. To combat the coffee rust, they have to buy a lot more medicines for the plants. It's a lot more resource intensive now to grow the coffee. It's more expensive as well. And so with all of these expenses, right now in Guatemala and Honduras, it can be more expensive to grow the coffee than the price they can sell it for at the market. This means that a lot of these big coffee farms are going underwater. They're selling off bits of their land to try to keep enough income to stay stable. They've pushed the price that they're, or the salaries of their workers, down to the absolute bare minimum, because well below the minimum wage. So it has ripple effects all the way down, not just for the coffee owners, but for all the workers. They're, you know, harvesting smaller amounts. And so for this large rural population that's been employed in coffee, now there's no money there.
And does that drive urbanization, or does that drive migration directly?
Both. So some people decide, and so one of the things I saw in the municipality where I was staying, and this is why it's often so hard to tease out one factor from the other, is that the lack of jobs in the coffee industry were pushing young men from this municipality to go to Guatemala City. And then 2 years ago, two of the men who were working as bus drivers were murdered. And so at that point, a lot of the other young men from the city decided, well, maybe I'm actually safer off trying to go to the U.S. and stay with my cousin. And so that's where it starts to get complicated. You have all these factors coming together where the economic options are disappearing. And then at the same time, the cities where you might be going to are so dangerous. And so it starts to feel like there's no place for you in your country anymore. The third reason, which ties into both of these, which is family reunification. And this is kind of the factor that comes into play because of these other factors, or for a third reason, which is children or parents no longer want to be separated from one another. And so it could be that the conditions are so bad that you have, you know, maybe children who were left behind when the parents migrated before, but now that the conditions of security or people are going hungry, the parents in the United States say, I'm going to pay a smuggler to bring my child so that they at least have something to eat, or I'm going to pay a smuggler to take my child so that they're not going to be harassed by the gangs. And so that's some of the unaccompanied minors that you see arriving at the border. Some of them fall into those categories of having a family member in the U.S. who paid money to a smuggler to bring their child so that they would be able to be with the parents in the United States.
All of which brings us back to the group of people that you were walking with for half a day. Tell us about them as people. I mean, you mentioned one who had been a cab driver in Honduras, but who were the others and why were they there?
I'll tell you about the family, because that's the one that I think really stuck with me. Now, there was a little boy, he was 6 years old, and he was extremely talkative. because to him, the migration was an adventure. He didn't understand what was happening or why his parents, both of whom worked in agriculture before and felt that they couldn't make a living or enough money for this child's future. So they hadn't explained to him at all what was happening. They were just describing it as a big trip they were taking. And so you have this little boy, and he was telling me things like, I got to ride a boat, and he was really excited. And he's like, I saw a snake, and he's really excited. And it really brought home, you know, first of all, you know, the humanity of it and just how I have a niece who's 6 years old, and I can imagine her doing the exact same things. So there's so many children out there, and their experiences are in the way that they also are perceiving these journeys. And that was something that really impacted me, of thinking about this little boy's, you know, what he'd already lived through and then what lay ahead of him, because he was only about 50 miles into Mexico and he had a very long way to go. And his parents, who had decided to make this journey with him, and what they must have been thinking, and especially thinking about the mother who was in charge of keeping him. He always wanted to kind of walk around near the road, and her big worry was that he was going to get too close to the center of the road and a car might come by and hit him. And so her fears, on top of everything else that she was thinking of, you know, in terms of actually getting to the border, but really taking care of this child, the six-year-old boy, who was excited and wanted to play and wanted to explore in a place that really wasn't safe for him. And so I think, you know, I think that's also something that they're really, that I'm still kind of processing, is just how much migrants in our debate right now are this faceless enemy and this faceless group that are either all asylum seekers or they're all, you know, MS-13 members. And when you're walking with people, it's complicated, and thinking about, you know, their own decisions, and then of course the way that each of them individually is thinking about the journey. And that was something that I hadn't really had the experience of traveling with a small child, and thinking about what it might look like for all these kids who are also in the caravan.
Is there an awareness on the part of the group of people that you traveled with of the domestic politics of the migration in the United States?
There is, absolutely. And one of the most interesting debates that happened on that particular walk was between one of the men who had actually been deported and was trying to make it back, and someone else, regarding whether or not it was a good thing that the U.S. had these laws and were so strict about letting people in. And it was a little surreal to hear two people who were embarking out, one of whom had been deported, and they were saying, you know, that's actually why we like the U.S. We like them because they have rule of law. And that was an interesting, unexpected conversation. Now, within that, there absolutely, this group of people was aware, number one, of the types of policies that the U.S. had implemented, and number two, what they could possibly implement, particularly with the caravan. And they talked about it. They couldn't really follow the news or anything because they didn't have cell phones while they were walking. But when they got to the shelters where there's internet, they checked their Facebook. They kind of got news through that source, talked to one another. So they were absolutely following it and aware. But particularly for this family, they were planning on going to a port of entry and seeking asylum. For others, it didn't matter because they were planning on paying a smuggler and trying to sneak in to go work in Houston or in kind of Seattle and different places across the country. And so they absolutely were thinking about it. They were talking about it. But at the same time, ironically, for as strict as these laws were, there were several in the group that really respected having those laws, even as they were about to break them. And I think that actually also goes back to just how complicated migration is, and sure, complicated everything is surrounding this. And we love to paint these broad strokes, but even among the migrants themselves, they're debating and arguing and debating U.S. laws and rule of law. And that's something that I don't think we think about too much in the United States.
So I'll let you go, but I want to ask one more question about this family that you've talked about, and you've described that they are planning to show up at a port of entry and apply for asylum, which is actually legal And so this is a family that has not violated or is not planning to violate any U.S. law. They're actually planning to walk 1,000 miles or travel 1,000 miles in order to comply with U.S. law. And so based on what you know about this family and their circumstances and where they're coming from and what their story is, what are their chances? They show up at a U.S. port of entry and apply for asylum and can show the things that they claim to or that you think they might be able to show. Are they people who the U.S. is open to, or are they people who are, you know, kind of going to get to the border and find out that they're out of luck?
There is a lot wrapped in that question, and it really gets to the crux of a lot of the issues. First of all, I have to say up front, I don't know what their asylum claim would be, because the only things I do know about them are that they worked in agriculture and that they couldn't make ends meet. And that's really the crux of the issue, because that's where you get people in the Trump administration and elsewhere saying, these are economic migrants who are masquerading as asylum seekers. And so it's a loophole, so we have to stop asylum, we have to figure it out. And I don't want to comment on this particular case, because I just don't know if they, I'm sure there are many, many, many things they didn't tell me, and why would you tell a random foreigner who joins your group as you're kind of walking north the details of your life. So I'm not sure, but that really is a complicated, that is the crux of a lot of what we're seeing right now, is that back and forth debate. I will say that there certainly are asylum cases where it is economic or family reunification. And because there are no pathways legally for people to reunite with their family members in the United States, or to get a temporary guest worker program to get a temporary guest worker visa to go work in the United States either, the only way to do it, the only way that people can get in, is often by seeking asylum. So there are people mixed in with the very valid asylum claims who do want to achieve these other things. They want to be with their mother or father. They want to be able to make money to send back to their, you know, their grandparents or their parents. And that all gets mixed in and it gets murky. And that's a lot of the debate kind of recently has been centering around that point of how many of these claims are fraudulent. Now, it is absolutely legal to make it to the U.S. border and to seek asylum. And a lot of the people will pass, I think it's 90% of people will pass the first step of a credible fear interview and be allowed to lodge their cases in the court system, in the immigration courts. Now, from then on, it gets trickier, because some percentage of people won't show up. Some percentage of people will have cases that go through, and there will be a percentage that don't have cases that are, well, they're deemed to not qualify for asylum. And so it does get murkier at that point. Overall, a lot of these claims have not been viewed as valid for asylum, and that will likely increase with Jeff Sessions, his recent ruling that domestic violence should not be a particular social group that should qualify people for asylum claims or asylum protection. However, there are amongst kind of, there are many valid asylum claims as well. And so there is still a percentage. Now, on asylum as well, it depends on where you are, where you file your claim. That's going to have a huge determination on whether or not your asylum claim is granted. For example, if you file in San Francisco, you're looking at, you know, 2/3 of cases are accepted. If you file in Atlanta, I think it's maybe under 10%, maybe under 5%. And so you're really, there's so many variables that go into these claims. If you're a family that's able to get pro bono legal assistance versus if you're an unaccompanied minor representing yourself. So it's pretty complicated, but really the issue of asylum is where we should be focusing. We shouldn't be focusing on the border. We should be looking at, how do we process so many people who are coming to the border? How do we, and seeking asylum, how do we process the enormous backlog that we have that's growing every year in asylum cases? And how do we do so in a way that's fair and that's speedy, and that doesn't leave people waiting years and years to have their cases actually determined? Because that's the reality today.
Stephanie Loiter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Stephanie Loiter for joining us mere hours after her return to the United States. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast, which has no promotional vehicles other than you. It's that five-star rating. It's that tweet. It's that share on Facebook. It's that talk about us at dinner party conversations where other people want to talk about caravans and you say, no, actually, we're going to talk about the Lawfare Podcast where there was the best discussion of the caravan. Our music, Caravan or Not, is performed by the one, the only, the Sophia Yan, and this week as all other weeks. Thanks for listening.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.